Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Scholarly Communication, the podcast about how knowledge gets known. I'm your host, Daniel Shea, and today I'll be talking to William Tierney about his book Get Real, 49 Challenges Confronting Higher Education, published by SUNY Press in 2020. Think about it. About what? About anything at all in higher education that needs thinking about. William Tierney has found in his book Get Real, 49 things that need thinking about, though truth be told, William Tierney's 49 things have many, many parts. Free speech, for example, relates to the beginnings of the research university in Germany, relates to academic freedom and the founding of the American Association of University Professors in 1915, relates to the mounting number of cases where microaggressions and First Amendment rights have rubbed enough to start fires, relates to fake news, relates to speech codes, relates to public censorship and self-censorship, and I'm just going to stop there. I think that if you multiply William Tierney's 49 by a factor of 5, you'll get a conservative estimate of all the issues he's covered in his book, Get Real, 49 Challenges Confronting Higher Education. There are a multiplicity of issues, and of course there are everywhere in our lives, and especially today, but just think about it. How important is higher education, and research, and the workforce of the 21st century? These are issues we've really got to think about. Get Real is an invitation to do just that. To think. In his preface, William Tierney tells of his classes at the University of Southern California and how his teaching method is to help students ground their understanding of issues and also to provide students with opportunities to construct their own arguments for or against what they understand, for or against what others understand. One aim is to get students thinking about divergent ways of understanding and about the connections that's possible between these. William's patent question as professor is, what do you think? And it's the question that you hear throughout the book, not in those words exactly, but in the words that William Tierney chooses to analyze the problems in higher education, and also in the words he chooses to address those same problems. For example, class attendance. William makes his own position clear. Students should attend class. However, that's not only what he thinks. He speaks with students. He attends the 300-seat lecture halls where just 70 students follow a lecture. And he runs a compare and contrast between how things were a generation ago and how things are today. His conclusion? More teaching can be done online, but not all teaching can be done online. More faculty and more administration need to be considering these sinking attendance levels. The majority of students don't skip because they're slacking, but some do. And so on. Get Real has its multiplicity of issues. William Tierney offers a multiplicity of views. That's because, again, the point is to start a conversation. Nothing better for higher education could happen than for the people involved to start talking about the issues involved. If we can discuss and come to an agreement as to what we believe, William writes, then we can come together about how to put those beliefs into concrete actions and policies. No way to know what we believe if we don't first think. Get Real is thinking practice in book form. William Tierney is a great thinking coach. William Tierney is university professor and Wilbur Kiefer professor of higher education and founding director of the Pulias Center for Higher Education at the University of Southern California. He's past president of the Association for the Study of Higher Education and the American Educational Research Association. His recent books include Rethinking Education and Poverty, Trust and the Public Good, Examining the Cultural Conditions of Academic Work, and New Players, Different Game, Understanding the Rise of For-Profit Colleges and Universities. So let's begin today's episode. William Tierney and Get Real. Bill, welcome to the Scholarly Communication.
Thank you very much.
This is a book that holds together very well with its interest in what's going on in higher education, what we need to think about, and where we might go, where we can go. It's also, though, very, very many views broken down into essay form. I wonder if you could tell us a bit of the germination process of the book.
Thanks a lot. I think there are two parts that we need to put on the table. One is the genesis of the book is that I have read a previous book that is entirely not related to higher education. Peter Singer, a philosopher, where he presented ideas like I do, and really was trying to encourage the reader, force the reader to think through what do they think. And I thought it was a great format. And I think that the other issue and why this book made sense to me is that dealing with topics in isolation, certainly there's a need and a purpose for that. But really, when you're at a university, all of these issues come together. And you can avoid, talking about academic freedom and only focus on teaching excellence, for example. But at the end of the day, those two topics are related. And we need to think of the wealth of topics that confront us, all of us in higher education, and how we want to deal with them to move forward aggressively in the 21st century. During the pandemic, with all social organizations, people have said, well, once we are all vaccinated and life returns to normal, does not mean that we're returning to pre-pandemic times. And I think that's true. But it also doesn't mean that we're going to start with a clean slate, that we're starting, we're erasing everything that we've been doing and moving forward. So that's what came up when I started writing the book, and it only accelerated because of the pandemic and then the racial activities, George Floyd being murdered in Minnesota this past year.
And then what you're saying is that the pandemic is showing up things that are already there, and the after pandemic time, if we, God help us, reach that time, will have to necessarily include the past, but needs to be forward-looking. I'm thinking in particular of the first section where you put quite provocatively the scenario in question, make believe that we don't have a higher education system, and let's think, how would we build it? What might you say on that point?
There are two interesting immediate lessons from the pandemic, at least in the United States. And the first one is that for a century, we have all said, oh boy, the problem with change in higher education is the faculty. The faculty are unwilling to change. And lo and behold, when COVID arose, and I'm on a variety of different faculty blogs, and literally a week before the world closed down, there were faculty saying, I can't imagine teaching without teaching in person. All this stuff online would just be a disaster. And 1 week later, all of the faculty changed on a dime. I mean, immediately. And I found that remarkable, that faculty who are looked on as curmudgeons who, will only look to tomorrow to decide what we're going to do tomorrow, in effect said, well, there's no choice. We have to do this immediately. So that's one point. A second point, and I think this is most interesting, is that for those who say, well, we want to move online, you know, it's just that's the way to go. Lo and behold, one thing that we discovered is that students actually like classes. They like being on a campus. Over the course of the year, there were times when I wrote op-eds in different formats. And, you know, when this in March or April of last year, I wrote an op-ed and I said that the, you know, we were at that time, it's this seems like ancient history, but at that time, we were all debating, well, will classes resume in September? And I wrote an op-ed and I said, look, we need to realize the severity of this pandemic, and we should decide now, because then we will have be able to plan. We should decide now as a system that we cannot have classes in person in the fall. And I was inundated with emails from high school students who were heading off to the university, as well as university students, who said, I understand what you're saying, but please don't say that. You know, I want to get out of my parents' house. I want to go to the university. I do not want to spend, you know, a year online the way I'm doing now. And I think, again, that, you know, that's important. I think that when we look at the pandemic, there are certain issues that I think actually we learned, and they're better. At least in a city like Los Angeles, where traffic is horrible, people, you know, resorted to using online telemedicine when you had a doctor's appointment. I think that is a great improvement. And again, in Los Angeles, rather than have to fight traffic for an hour and a half, sit in the doctor's waiting room for half an hour, and then, you know, see the guy and then repeat it, versus just turning on your laptop and seeing the guy on your laptop is terrific. But it's also true that people, you know, I think the restaurant industry will come back in a vibrant manner because people want to socialize and get out. The same, I think, is true in higher education. I think that, yes, we can make significant improvements with regard to online learning, but people, students, like a campus where they can be together and sit in classes with faculty. I should also say another interesting point that, you know, that I think before the pandemic, people would not have said, is that before the pandemic, you know, one line that we often hear is, oh, faculty just want to do research and stay in their offices. They don't care about students. Well, and, you know, one of the most recent surveys I saw is that over 50% of the faculty in the United States said that they had spent a considerable amount of time counseling students online because of, you know, how hard it was this past year. So rather than an uncaring multitude of faculty just wanting to do their own work, we saw the opposite. And I think that's important because especially traditionally aged students, they do need to be able to converse with adults about the, you know, the myriad issues that confront their lives when they're 18, 19, 20 years old.
I can also, with further anecdotes, support the what you're saying there about the counseling that faculty have given to students and being there for them and seeing them as people and understanding their role as educators beyond merely just the subject content entirely. I would like to follow that up, though, on this students wanting to be on campus, wanting to be there. A lot in the book addresses the activities that are outside of class, the extracurriculars.
Yeah.
And it becomes then quite clear that so much that is formative occurs there as well. I wonder if you could fill us in a bit in that direction.
Sure. You know, the way a lot of us think about teaching and learning is, you know, the clinical terms are cognitive variables and non-cognitive variables. The cognitive variables are pretty well understood, reading, writing, arithmetic. And, you know, are students reading at grade level? Are they, and this is throughout all of education, you know, are students performing up to their particular grade in mathematics, because the assumption is that it's a building block, and to move to B, you have to master A first. And that's generally what's happening in the classroom, and certainly true. But non-cognitive variables are a little more difficult to get your hands on. And you know, in this day and age, I think that we need to come to grips with, how do people work in teams? How do people communicate across differences, not simply in class, but also outside of class? You know, several years ago, and I think I have this in the book, there had been a very unfortunate incident at a university in the United States regarding race. And they brought me out there, and they wanted me to do an assessment of what was the racial climate like at the university. And I remember sitting in a room with a bunch of Black students and white students. There were no Latinos or Asian Americans. And, you know, it was a really sad conversation, because there had been a major disruption on the campus prior to my arrival. And it was over the summer. And one of the black students said to me that he was home when this happened. And he said his parents, especially his mom, were terrified of sending him back to a location that they thought was unsafe. And, you know, I think any parent can resonate with that. You know, that's an issue that is centered in race, but goes beyond race. That what parent would want to send their child to an environment that's not safe? And we need to take that into account. But at the same time, there was a young woman, a white woman, who was from a rural area in the state. And, you know, as only a 19-year-old can say, she said, you know, I have a lot of questions about what it's like to be Black. She said, but I'm afraid to ask, because I don't want to ask a cheesy question and get embarrassed. And again, I thought, you know, can we all identify with that there's things that you just don't understand? But now we're in an environment that, rather than asking a question in as honest a way as possible, you're afraid to ask, so you stifle the question. That's not a good environment for learning at a university in general. But I think that a university should be the fountainhead for this, that we need to figure out ways to provoke a positive environment where we can ask difficult questions and help students as well as one another think through these often very tough topics right now.
And I think it's obvious that your experience there at that school needed to be in a seminar-like context. I mean, you needed to be with these people together. You make the very good point in the book of seeing much vocational training or knowledge-based learning possible to be put online. But when you're dealing with critical thinking or emotions, then the seminar becomes the basis of what it is that you're doing. And I think that you're... Okay, well, maybe, please, yeah.
No, you know, Daniel, I the pandemic is a good learning experience for us. And I think that when we talk about going in-person versus online learning, it almost seems like we're creating a dichotomy that it's either or, you know, that either we're going to do this or we're going to do that. And I don't think that's correct anymore. And, you know, just for my own personal experience, we've been locked in our houses all year. So there are a couple different things that I have done. One is that I am rereading James Joyce's Ulysses, and I'm doing it with a group of friends internationally, actually. There's seven of us, and we meet once a week visibly over Zoom to discuss the topic. And there's also a podcast that I listen to every day about one of the confusing pages. Every page is confusing in Joyce. A second topic is that I'm in Santa Fe, New Mexico right now, which is a beautiful city in the United States. And there's a liberal arts college here, St. John's College, and I'm rereading The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. And in about a month, I'm going to have an in-person seminar, an intensive seminar for a week, for 2 hours a day for 5 days, to discuss Dostoevsky with other people interested in the topic. And then the third thing is I had a lapse of 40 years, but I picked up where I left off and started learning to play chess again. And 40 years ago, when I learned to play chess, I bought the requisite books and, you know, did paper and pencil and figured out how to play. Now, everything is online, and it is remarkable that they can, you know, the ability to be able to create a challenger for me who knows my weaknesses, so that when I play and I lose, I've learned why I lose and then overcome that and then something else. And I think those are three useful examples for thinking about higher education going forward, that clearly there are needed times when we need to have classes in person where people can talk about topics, but sometimes they can be speeded up. You know, the format in the United States is an agrarian format that, you know, I teach my class for 3 hours. It's a graduate seminar, 3 hours a week, one day in the morning, and then it goes for 15 weeks. And there are some examples like chess that, why can't we have experiences for students that speeds up learning, that if they go away for the summer, that there is some real, viable, good online learning experience that we can craft for a student that enables the individual to learn, but also doesn't take, you know, 4 years plus to graduate from college. And I think my hope is that those are the sorts of issues that we think about, rather than, well, let's go back and do it exactly the way we were doing it a year ago. And again, you know, by no means am I saying that the bulk of activities should be that we bring students to campus, they're in their dorm room, and all of their activities are online. But I think the opposite is false, too, because we know that, you know, right now, the internet is ubiquitous. You use it for everything. So we can craft those in useful ways that are co-curricular as well as standalones. But the centerpiece is students and faculty working with one another.
I agree that there clearly has to be an intelligent mix. If I think of my own teaching practice here at Heidelberg University, I run the writing program primarily for the biosciences. And I would say about 60-70% of the writers that I help are reaching me directly from the lab. Yeah. And they're so thankful for that opportunity because, right, you know, they turned me off and they're back at the experiment.
Right. And but you know, that's, I had forgotten that you're in the writing program. I think that's another good example that, you know, I teach mainly graduate students, and over my career, I have had, you know, just a wide gamut of students in terms of race, gender, and economic class. And writing is crucial to me. It's, you know, And maybe if I hadn't been a literature major in college and I'd been a math major, then I would say math. But that's not the case. Literature and writing has always been central to my life. And there's a lot of things that we can do online. And I am a very severe critic of students' writing. So, you know, if you send me a paper, you will get lots of comments on it. But I can't tell you the number of times that students have said to me that the import of talking with me one-on-one in my office with the door closed. And you know, if I were to boil it down to one comment, it's that me saying to them, you can do it. That I know you can do it. I will never embarrass you publicly. I will never embarrass you in class. But we've got to work harder on this rather than just let it slide. And you know, the encouraging thing for me is that students will always rise, at least for me, have always risen to the challenges and goals that I've set for them. What they don't resonate to is being ignored or being talked down to. And that's, you know, that's the key. And again, part of it is essential that you've got to be there with the student and helping them work through the, you know, these truly horrible comments I've made about all, you know, all the errors they've had in their writing.
I think that some of that, and again, this gets back to this question of mix. I think that some of that reaching out and honestly seeing the writer as a person, right? The writer has created a product, but the writer is also, you know, moving ideas and trying to reach purposes. So there's a person behind this, which is, you know, let's say a more abstract way of looking at what you've just said. And I think that you can achieve some of that virtually in a face-to-face Zoom type meeting. And I think there's also times very much, just as you said, in the office with the door closed. Would you agree there? Do you think that there are possibilities on both ends?
Absolutely. I mean, I have gone on sabbatical at times as well. And I've 3 or 4 years ago, I spent a year in India, you know, and life doesn't stop for my graduate students. So I would Zoom with them every week. At that time, it was Skype with them every week. It takes getting used to, but I was able to do that. But you can give students exercises, but you know, writing, I mean, I don't need to tell you this, but I mean, writing is a dialogue. And I think the larger worry that I have right now is that rather than have the potential of creating conflict, you know, of having a student be angered or insulted or hurt by your comments, and then you getting in trouble, you, the faculty member, getting in trouble. Too often right now, what I'm seeing is faculty avoiding the issue altogether. You know, and I'll read a paper and you'll give me a paper and I'll read it and I'll say, boy, this student really has a lot of writing problems. You know, what did you tell the individual? And you said, well, I said it was pretty fine because I know that this student talks with other students and I could get a bad reputation and I could get in trouble. And that's a problem. And that's a problem of faculty not knowing how to navigate a critical space for learning. And it's a missed opportunity, but simply going entirely online is not going to solve that problem. And again, in this day and age, if you're not dealing with technology the way students are dealing with it, we've got an issue as well. I mean, here's a funny anecdote from a million years ago, if you can remember this, I don't know. So there were times, my handwriting is horrible. So even before the internet, I would type out my responses and I would, students would hand in a paper and then I would put a paper clip and they'd have my comments. And one of my grad students said to me, I need to help you figure out how to embed comments online. And I said, oh, I don't do that. You know, I like it this way. Typical faculty response. And the fellow said to me, you don't want to be looked on as someone who's out of it. Let me walk you through this. And I thought, what a great response, because you need to be there with students in terms of, you know, helping them deal with the world that they live in today rather than the world that you grew up in.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That sounds like where the title came from. Get real.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I'd like to come back to this idea of dialogue that you were talking about in writing, because you actually draw that out to the teaching context in very interesting ways. I'll just pick up from the diversity section the example of microaggressions. And you talk about the teacher actually being able to not even avoid, but let's say create an environment where a microaggression won't happen because of the dialogical relationship that comes about when the teacher doesn't see him or herself anymore as authority, but as a guide, adapting, I think you say even at some point to the class. Yeah. So the teacher not, let's say, being translators in chief is certainly one of the phrases I think you use there, but the teacher rather, you know, approaching the class in a manner that accepts, you know, we are all learners and we all require respect and understanding. That put me in mind, for instance, of the 19-year-old woman who, you know, from a rural area said, I actually want to talk about things and can't. Right. Because if you think about it, like microaggressions, which are, you know, systemic discrimination, which is terrible, but being just a human can in very many ways just be systematically terrible. And I think there is that obvious way of sharing.
Right. Early on in that book, I give an example from my own life that I think is instructive. So, you know, I'm gay and I'm happily married now and all that. But when I was in graduate school at Stanford, I was in a seminar, graduate seminar, a small seminar of about a dozen folks. And it was a great seminar and it was a great group of students. And at that time, I was closeted and not out. Yeah, so I was entirely, in. And the class was not inflammatory at all. I think it was about methodology and interviews and observations. How do you do these things? And there was another student in the class who was a friend of mine. And she was interviewing women, poor women. And she was white. And she said at one point, I don't know how to cross these barriers. These are good people. I mean, they're not like criminals, prostitutes, or homosexuals. And everybody, including me, knew exactly what she meant. And it was a well-intentioned comment. And the professor in the seminar table, you know, nodded his head and we talked about that. But what I raise in the book is that stopped learning for me that day. I mean, I lowered my head. I didn't want anybody to go, whoa, boy, you know, look at him. He's blushing or something like that. And that today is what we would call a microaggression. Today, because students are less willing to sit still, somebody would probably call the individual on that. But, you know, that friend of mine who asked that question is not unlike the young woman who said, I'm afraid to ask cheesy questions. And that's the dynamic of the classroom. And again, what you see with administrators is really what they want is they don't want to have to deal with these issues. You know, it's like, oh boy, we're going to have protests either from, you know, the students or the right wing or whatever. So let's avoid this topic. And, you know, at one point we would have called that a teachable moment. The faculty member could have said, wait a second, let's think about this for a minute. But the teacher didn't blink because, again, we all knew the understanding of the question. But I think that is something that today faculty have to confront. And you know, years and years ago, before I was at the University of Southern California, I was at Pennsylvania State University in the East, a large public university. This is in the late 1980s, early 1990s. And there was some protest that happened about learning in the classroom. And it was largely from students of color and African-American students and gays and lesbian and women. It was a big protest. And I remember a friend of mine who's in the math department, and again, a well-meaning guy. And he said, "Boy, I don't envy you. I really, you know, I'm so glad that I teach math where I don't have to deal with these issues." And I thought, well, there you go, you know, because are you teaching a subject or are you teaching students? And clearly you're teaching a subject, but you're not teaching a subject to avoid. And, you know, when we make offhanded comments, when we say to a student of color in a difficult math class, you know, to be honest, when the class started, I never would have thought you, you know, would have performed as well as you do. The instructor is thinking that he or she is giving a compliment to the student, when actually that's a real slap in the face. For someone like you, you're great. And we have to think about those things and think about how do we create an environment where we enable constructive conversation occur and not stifle it, but deal with the issues.
Yeah, and you make very clear in the book that diversity is such a broad issue. It's not merely a question of interpersonal relationships between, you know, professor and student, or between student and students, or what happens on campus, although it is all that as well. But it goes so deep as to affect how it is that we learn, what it is that we perhaps decide to learn, and how those fields themselves advance. The Nature podcast, Working Scientist, has made a great study of the natural sciences and how diversity in every field, from chemistry into physics and all the way through and all the way between, advance their knowledge better when they have diverse teams of scientists. I quote from what you say in your book, "Let's jump forward a decade. If there are not significantly more tenured faculty of color and women in the sciences than there are today, the academy will be weaker."
Yeah. And I also think that people tend to, you know, they come from a situation, they come to a problem or an issue or an individual from their standpoint, from who they are. I remember a long time ago, I read some research about couples, and this were heterosexual couples, husband and wife. And it made me laugh because one of the issues that came up was that when there was a problem, you know, if a husband came home and the wife were to say, "This happened," that especially white men are problem solvers. Well, okay, this is what we need to do. You know, and you create a plan and you figure out how to solve the problem. And oftentimes what women were saying was, "I don't need that. I need somebody to listen to me." You know, it's like, this is a conversation. And that was a real learning example for me, is that, when I work with students, sometimes students don't need me to give the answer the problem for them. They need to know that I'm there with them. That when a student passes a qualifying exam and, there are issues in the qualifying exam for the dissertation, sometimes immediately after the meeting, the faculty member will go back in the office and say, "Okay, Daniel, here are the three issues that we need to do. You know, we need to rewrite this and rewrite that and then read more in this area." And actually what the student is not listening to that in the least. They're thinking, "Phew, I passed." And that's where you need to meet the student rather than being the answer man. And I think that's the issue. And different people bring different skills to the table. And that's why we need to be a more diverse group of individuals in the academy.
And I could very much associate with this idea of sometimes a question is really not asking for an answer. It's asking for a personal response in a way. You say white men, and I entirely agree. This certainly fits the stereotype. I happen to be a white man married to a Greek woman, and I have to say some Greek women are also problem solvers and misunderstand entirely what it is that I'm after. But to make this less personal and a little bit more applied to wider higher education situation, in the area of writing, when I think of my writing consultations that I run, I mean, you'll know, writing is a tricky thing to teach, and it's very personal. And what I often find in the consultations is precisely what you're talking about. I will leave a consultation thinking along the lines that, well, I didn't really get the chance to, you know, dig into the sentences or talk about structure or whatever, but I'll get an email and it will be, thanks so much. I really see now what's going on. And I'll be like, what did I do? Yeah. I must have been listening, I guess.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's sort of the teachable moment is that, you know, it's an interesting environment right now. You know, in my office, because I was director of the center and where I am, I'm a busy guy. And they also teach you that, you know, you want to make sure that there's no feigned intimacy or real intimacy. So I would often leave my door open and the student would come in and sit down. And invariably over time, what I saw was that the student would close the door. And the student, and I finally figured out, the student closed the door for two reasons. One is that if the door is open and somebody passing by sees me, they could stop in, and as you know, with faculty, just for a minute, you know, to ask the question that they want to ask. And the student was telling me, this is my time, you know. And the other thing is, especially graduate students, the student may end up in tears because they're trying so hard and they want me to say, this is absolutely the greatest thing that's ever been written. And I'm not going to say that, but they also want it to be a safe space. And that, you know, the classroom needs to be a safe space. And it's hard for us to concoct that, especially now when the internet is so strong that, you know, we all have examples of colleagues who have said and made an errant comment. Sometimes they're boneheaded, stupid comments, but they didn't mean anything bad by it. And then all of a sudden, a student walks out, gets on Twitter, says, this is what, you know, Professor Shea said. And all of a sudden, you know, you go to wait a lunch and come back and you're bombarded with 500 tweets on what a terrible human being you are. And you don't know how to deal with it. So, you know, the lesson you get from that is, well, I'm going to watch my words. I'm not going to say anything errant in the conversation. And again, that's the wrong lesson to learn.
And it's certainly the lesson that your book preaches not to go down that road, because this whole call to let's talk, let's think, which comes out so clearly in the book, is exactly what we need. You started off in our interview here talking about, you know, the reputation or the stereotypes surrounding faculty who were being resistant to change, and giving a brilliant example of, you know, how that doesn't quite seem to be the case. Mm-hmm. And that makes me think that I wonder what is resisting change. And throughout the book, you get a very clear picture of how the university has been developing, at least say, let's, you know, approximately from mid-century to 1950s, right. 1960s. And what comes out as a clear picture, and anyone who's in higher education will know this, is the mass of administration going on. You have an entire section devoted to, you know, the governance, the president, the board, and so on. I wonder what role they might be playing in the unwillingness to change. And if I think of just maybe to give an example, but go any direction you'd like with this, if I think, for instance, of writing instruction, it seems to be one of those things that it doesn't fit into a rubric. It doesn't quite match with any disciplinary knowledge. So, well, that's a first cut.
No, I, you know, one of the interesting examples, I think, and given the time frame you just laid out, is I think, and people don't talk about this, but oftentimes the board, the administration, and the faculty are in cahoots with one another, in the sense that the marker is improve in the rankings. You know, and this in the United States, we saw this, that, you know, a teacher's college would become a university, a state university, and then it would try to move away from teaching and move towards research. And the board members could feel good about, you know, boy, I came in and my institution was 250th, and now it's 100. Isn't that, we're doing a great job, we the board. The administration, because of the United States, we have presidents that are stepping stones. They move from one institution to the next. That what they will say is, I transformed the institution. We were 250 and now we're 100. And the faculty will say, yep, the students are better. And the problem with writing centers, to narrow specifically on writing centers, is that writing centers often are seen as problems. You know, that kids go to the writing center because they have a problem. Well, wouldn't it be great if we don't have, you know, if we don't have writing centers, that means we don't have students who have problems, which of course is the exact wrong way to think about an essential skill that we need for the 21st century. I think the other issue that we have to deal with is, and I've been thinking a lot about this over the pandemic, that if you look at the various crises that higher education has faced, there is probably no greater crisis for higher education since World War II than the pandemic. And the pandemic, you know, and I'm not by any means downplaying the crisis that we're in. My own university, a private university, lost $500 million this year. The University of California at Berkeley, a public institution, lost $1 billion. So I appreciate that everybody was internally focused and worried about, you know, how are we going to deal with this? But during World War II, universities were centrally involved in working towards defeating the Nazis. You know, that there were research efforts undertaken. There's comments and quotations from university presidents all over the country that says, we're shortening the faculty have agreed to shorten the learning scheme for students so that they can graduate and go off to war, that we're going to work with, you know, different places to train people to fight. The result of that after World War II was that the standing by the public of higher education was inordinately high. In the United States, what we saw was a boom in federal funding. The National Science Foundation was created. The National Institutes of Health was created. And really, they looked on research universities as engines of central engines for the country. I don't think that's the case today. And again, that's part of the reason I've written this book, is that I think, you know, in the United States, when the sun set all over the country, you know, it was stirring. Everybody stuck in their houses. And when the workers came home from hospitals, be they nurses or doctors, there are people standing out on their front porches, you know, applauding them, saying, you know, bravo. I think if I said that about universities, do we have, you know, when you go home, is your neighborhood applauding that Daniel's coming home from a hard day's work? I don't think so. And that, I think, is a real issue, is that the public perception of higher education has fallen. And the result is that universities are constantly looked on as just another entity that needs money. And we're competing against everybody. And that's a losing situation for us. And then we start to say, well, what areas are not essential? What can we cut? And what we do is we'll cut tenure track faculty in the United States. We'll cut writing programs because, well, you know, we don't have to have them. And that's You know, before we get an answer, you have to acknowledge the problem. And I'm trying to point out here, this is the problem, so that we can develop an answer. And the knee-jerk response by administrators is to simply say, well, I have to raise money. That's what I do. And I don't think that's necessarily the truth.
Yeah, I mean, you make a wonderful point there with the situation in World War II. And I think inside and outside the university, let's say the people who aren't directly connected, as you say, the wider public, or the people who are, let's say, primarily teaching, I don't think either of these groups would be typically all that impressed by, you know, the board who turns around and says, well, we were 250, now we're 175. You know, we've achieved something. What have you achieved? It's almost like a parallel universe. And I think anyone who sees, as you make very clear in the book, what the R1 universities actually do, what the R1 universities typically do is they cost a lot of money. They create, research environments which are entirely undiverse, which is not what we need. And as you also say, this is a one-size-fits-all mentality. We need only R1 universities. We don't.
Yeah. No. And, you know, a previous president of mine, who was a good mentor to me, said to me once that in the United States, we use the phrase Board of Trustees. And he said, it's hard for me to get across when I ask a member to join the board. The trustee means that you are holding the trust. You know, yeah, there's all this other stuff. There's fiduciary responsibility and all these different issues. But the reality is you're holding the trust of the university, and you need to, that's what you need to guard. You know, and some years ago, and I mentioned this in the book, I did a study of public boards of trustees. You know, and I had some governors, who would speak off the record to me and say, it's crazy. He said, trying to recruit a board member to a university that vitally needs, you know, an intelligent person on a board that can provide guidance is really difficult, because what I get is the board member who wants to be at a university where there's a football team and they want tickets to the 50-yard line, the center, you know, the center of the stadium, on Saturdays in the fall. And he said, that's not what a board member should be thinking about. You know, that I've gotten elected to this board, and isn't that great, because I can now go to 6 home football games, and by God, I hope our football team, you know, has a winning season. That is so, you know, not important in the grand scheme of things, but that's where we are today. And frankly, you know, to add on today, the real problem we're seeing in the United States is the politicization of boards. We're seeing boards that are inserting themselves in the university in entirely inappropriate ways. You know, you may have heard just recently, there's a public university, University of North Carolina, where the board, that through typical academic channels, there was a recommendation to give a person of color, an African-American woman, a tenured faculty position in journalism. And the board said, no, she can be a lecturer, but we will not give her tenure. That's entirely inappropriate. You know, I don't have any problems in an academic way that faculty in that individual's area of intellectual pursuit to say, whatever, you know, the research is weak, or the writing is weak, or the publications are weak, so we reject that. But if it works all the way up to the board, for the board to insert itself and say, we don't like what she's writing, which is really what they're saying, that flies in the face of everything we know about good governance for boards of trustees. And I think that problem is only going to grow.
One of the more terrible sides of what an administration can do against a university, it would seem, definitely.
Yeah, then. Absolutely. Yeah.
You know. There is one note I made to myself, and it would be I would be aggravated with myself if I didn't return to it. You make some really interesting comments again about writing and also about math. So You mentioned briefly the idea that, you know, writing center is seen as remedial, and without it, then we would be, you know, free of certain problems in our yeah. education system. And this is clearly not the most productive way of looking at it. But you say at one point about writing, the evaluation of writing is one of the simplest and most confusing topics I have encountered. And the statement intrigued me, and I wonder if maybe you could expand on that.
Well, the easiest in the sense that when there's subject-verb disagreement, you know, we've got a problem. So that's an issue. But this is not foremost, but it's central in my mind right now. As I work my way through James Joyce's Ulysses, I have said multiple times to my friends on Zoom, you know, if this guy were writing in my class, I would create real problems with him because he's writing in a way that no one can understand. But of course, Joyce is a master of the 20th century writing. And Leopold Bloom, one of the central characters of Ulysses, is probably one of the key fictional characters in all of literature. So that's the complex part of it, is trying to help an individual develop their own voice, not my voice, and be able to say something provocative in a way that draws the reader in, rather than you just throw the book across the room and say, I'm not going to read this. I'm going to go online and read the Monarch Notes version of it. Hmm. You know, the podcast I listen to, and it's Frank Delaney, who has passed away tragically, but I was saying this to a friend yesterday, that there are times in the podcast where he will read, you know, a page or two paragraphs that Joyce has written. And one of the components of any novel, there's a narrative sentence, and he will read that narrative sentence and he'll say with great enthusiasm, isn't that a great sentence? Think about how to say that in a better way. You know, you just try right now. And part of it is infectious, that the guy is trying to excite you about, you know, the wonders of language. But he's also pointing out that it could be a very confusing sentence, but it is a phenomenal sentence. And, you know, that's what I think, what you want in a writer and a reader is to be able to think that, not simply that the subject-verb agreement is correct, but that this is exactly what I want to say. And I'm conveying it in a way that is not only clear to Bill, but is also clear to Daniel, the reader. And that's difficult. I mean, it's confusing and difficult. And again, you're taking a risk with a student when you say that, when you're dealing with a diverse student body or you're dealing with diverse topics.
Interesting as well in that area was what you have to say about math. And you, I mean, again, an anecdote from my side, my nephew, when he was in his senior year, took calculus and was having a bit of trouble. So a family friend who happens to be an engineer, we call him up and wonder, you know, could you perhaps provide some help? And his first comment was, sure, although I'm not sure how good I'm going to still be at calculus. I don't need it for my job.
Yep. Yeah.
And this is one of those things that made me think, yeah, I mean, math, you know, being a formal science would be perfectly combined with logic, which is what a democratic public need to be able to work with on a daily basis.
Right. You know, I read a funny quote from a friend of mine. He put it on Facebook, and, you know, taxes are due in the United States on April 15th every year. And in early April, he put this statement on and said, I am so glad that I learned parallelograms for parallelogram season, because it's really made my life easier. And who needs anything about taxation? And I thought that's so true. If you told me, hey, you know, Bill, send me a parallelogram now and solve it, I would not have the slightest idea. But our financial literacy in the United States is so key right now, that it's so low. I also say in the book that, you know, part of what I have done is I've worked with low-income students in high schools to help them transition to universities. And it was a very different environment for me to, you know, all of a sudden I'm not in the classroom, I'm in a high school listening to students. And their financial literacy is abysmal. You know, they will say, if it's a grant or a loan, their phrase is, this is free money. You know, it's not money that I have to write for my bank account. Well, as we all know, a loan is not free money. And consequently, we've got students who are racking up loans of $100,000 while they're in university. And they have no idea, you know, how interest works. Well, that's a recipe for disaster. And it falls, as always, on the poor, that the poor are the ones who get screwed over when we're just teaching basic calculus, you know, to jump through the hoops.
Well, Bill, thank you. And you've been very generous with your time. I'd like to give you one last question leading us out. What is it that you see as the much of your book points to, let's talk, let's think about what we need to change. And I was wondering, what would you see as one of the most immediate or biggest or most important obstacles to that change? Or to quote from your book, who or what is it that prevents us from envisioning and enacting a dramatically different post-secondary experience?
You know, if you'd asked me before the pandemic, I would say that it's the thought that we're going to stay the course, that the way we develop tomorrow is based on yesterday. And I think that's different right now. My biggest fear is that that's where a lot of thinking and energy is going right now. That, and again, the board, the faculty, and the administration, what do they want for tomorrow? What do they want for September when the fall begins? The board wants a balanced budget. They just don't want to face another horrible debt the way we faced it. The administration wants the same thing, and they want that because they want students to come back to dormitories, they want students eating on campus, and they want students paying tuition. And the faculty want to get out of the house and go back to the life that they had as faculty members. But that's not sustainable. It's not sustainable not only because of the pandemic, but because of all these issues that I faced. So, you know, I don't want to be overly critical of groups that have worked extraordinarily hard over the last year. But I think for the next year, we need to think about what kind of environment do we want to enable us to move forward in a very treacherous time in the United States and really throughout the world. And, you know, the important point is to acknowledge that universities have been central organizations in the advancement of democracy. And right now, democracy is under attack in many countries. India, certainly, in the United States, if we look at what happened to Hong Kong. And rather than universities go dark and try to avoid the challenges, we need to think about how do we move forward in a concerted effort. And I think that's, you know, the public needs to be there with us, not simply for us, but with us, understanding the challenges we face and providing us with the latitude and energy to move forward.
Well, thank you very much. That is William Tierney, and his book, Get Real, 49 Challenges Confronting Higher Education, is out since last year with SUNY Press. I'm Daniel Shea, and this is goodbye from me to Bill. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
And this is goodbye to all of you. Bye-bye, and until next time here on Scholarly Communication.